to show.
Did you know that Eric wears dentures that have been in his family for generations?
It's true. They're discolored and disgusting.
But they have deep personal meaning for Eric, so we ask that you respect that.
And now your host,
Eric Metaxas.
I'm afraid to smile now because of the blueberry stains on Grandma's dentures. And you know what? That's none of your business, Todd.
Yeah.
So get out of my face, literally.
Yeah, hey. Get it. It's his chompers, his family's chompers. Let him alone.
They're at least they're better than your stained tobacco choppers, Todd.
Yeah, back off, man.
Todd has the goofiest looking false teeth, if you've ever seen him. It's hard to believe that he's not part horse.
I try to look away, basically.
Okay, here's the story, Albin.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to do a serious show.
We are.
Todd always knocks us off our game.
Yeah,
not right. Today... it's Friday already.
Oh, yeah, that's why we're goofy, right?
Today, we are talking in both hours to a dear friend, Owen Strahan. Now, his name is spelled Strahan, as he will tell you. Owen Strahan is a theologian, brilliant young man, has written many books. We will be talking to him about most of those books, and especially the new one, which, well, why should I tell you now? He'll be here in a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Reenchanting Humanity is the title. Look it up, Reenchanting Humanity. It's beautiful. Okay, I want to talk about Christmas in New York, Albin.
Mm.
Christmas in New York, two nights ago they put up the Christmas tree in Rockefeller Center, which is a nightmare. You don't want to go anywhere near that neck of the woods because it's like 5 million people come from New Jersey to see them light the tree. I don't get it.
Mm.
But anyway, and then there are people performing and stuff. But I bring that up because Christmas in New York can be a magical time. Emphasis on can be.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it ain't, but it can be. Here are a couple things you can do if you come to New York. Every year I want to tell people, come to New York, or if you're coming to New York, there's great stuff to do. You can visit our studio, by the way. Anybody, I mean, I'm not kidding. You could show up here with a $1,000 check for CSI.
Yes.
And you can say, I want to visit the studio. It's better to email us first through the website. But I'm telling you, anybody who wants to visit the studio, we've got a dad and his daughter coming in today.
Yes.
They gave some months ago. And I just want to tell you, anybody who comes, if you give $1,000 to one of these charities, you can hang with us in the studio. Trust me, it's fun. If you're coming to New York and you want to give to a superb charity, CSI, you go to our website. Metaxastalk.com to give to the charity. But if you think you're going to be in New York, you know, between now and whatever Christmas, if we happen to be here, you can come on in and hang. And trust me, it's fun. And there's free food.
Yeah, sandwiches.
And Albin will comb your hair whether you want it or not.
That's right.
And also, if you come to New York this Monday, Melanie Penn, our friend Melanie Penn, you can go to melaniepenn.com, is performing her annual Christmas concert. That's the 9th. That's this coming Monday here in New York at Rockwood Music Hall. I may be at that. I will tonight be at her event in Newtown, Connecticut, melaniepenn.com. Our friend Max McLean, who puts on this spectacular theater, Fellowship of the Performing Arts Theater, all around the country, he has brought to New York The Great Divorce, which is C.S. Lewis's classic, beautiful, spectacular, small masterpiece, The Great Divorce. He has brought that to the stage. And that's going to be in New York December 12th. So it starts next week until, I think, the 29th. If you're here for the holidays, you've got to go see Max McLean's great production of The Great Divorce. And on the 18th of December, our friends, the Gettys.
Yes.
I mean, come on.
Yeah.
This is, everybody knows the Gettys. You can go to Getty Music and check out their, they're all over the country.
Right.
But they're in New York at Carnegie Hall.
Carnegie Hall.
Keith Getty and his lovely fifth wife. Hard to believe.
I'm
just kidding. His first wife, Kristen, is going to be performing with him. Carnegie Hall. I will definitely be at that event with friends and family December 18th. Here in New York, all this great stuff going on in New York City and more. But I'm not kidding. If we're in the studio when you're here, if anybody gives $1,000 to CSI, you know, you can bring five people, whatever. It's not just one person. You can come on in, and we would just love to see you and meet you. So that's something to think about. CSI is an important thing in our lives right now. Very, very important.
It
we are
really
raising
is.
Funds for them so they can free slaves in the Sudan. We had a bishop from Nigeria the other day talking about the horrors of what's going on in certain parts of Nigeria, how dangerous it is for Christians. And I just want to say we in the West need to step up and put our money where our mouths are. Some of us need to put our mouths where God's brain is, you know, like think about and talk about what is on God's heart, God's mind, God's heart. We need to be serious and think about this. You know, what we are facing in this country is nothing compared to what they're facing in other countries, and we need to help them. And I really think that when we help them, we get blessed big time. It somehow connects us to the church around the world. Not somehow, but in more than one way, connects us to the church around the world, and helps us to get closer to God, because these people are suffering for their faith. So if you go to our website, metaxastalk.com, you'll see the banner for CSI. There's all kinds of ways you can give. First of all, anybody who gives anything is enrolled in our grand prize drawing. We have five grand prizes. Two of them involve visits to the studio, and these are transferable. So let's say you give $50 to CSI, okay? You're put into the drawing. If you win, you get to come with friends. We don't put a limit on it. If you want to come with a group of people to visit the studio, anybody who gives $1,000, you get to do that. But let's say you give $50. We put your name in the hat, and there's a drawing. There are going to be three people who are chosen to win that, okay? And every one of them can bring friends or whatever, and these are transferable. So I say to you, if you know somebody who's coming to New York, you say, well, I'll never get there, okay? I live in Hawaii. I live in Wisconsin. I'm not coming to New York. Well, maybe you know somebody who is coming to New York who lives in the New York area. They'd like to visit. This is transferable, folks. So for $50 or $100 or whatever you can give, you're put in the drawing, and it's just a wonderful gift. Two of the grand prizes are signed books. I will sign a Bonhoeffer book, and if you can keep it, book, a Donald Drains the Swamp book, a Donald Builds the Wall book, a Miracles book, on and on, a Luther book, all these books, plus other books from other guests. We really want to bless you.
Six Hamster Holmes books.
You know what? I forgot.
Yeah.
Albin is an author. I am an author. We will sign all of our books to you.
That's right.
My Uncle Muggsy book. I can't forget at Christmas to mention Uncle Muggsy. That's my favorite Christmas book of all time, because the illustrations by Tim Raglan are the most beautiful thing you've ever seen. And it's a huge book. It's not a normal size book.
No, it's huge,
But all of this stuff, folks, we want to encourage you to give to CSI. So these drawings are pretty spectacular, but I want to say anybody who gives $1,000, you automatically can come to the studio and visit us anytime the next year. Anybody who gives $250, you are freeing a slave. And I've said, if you give $500, you are freeing two slaves. You have to think about it this way.
Mm-hmm.
If you're giving $10,000, you get to have dinner with us at a restaurant of your choice. You bring as many people as you want, whatever. We want to meet the people that are generously giving to these things that we care about. But I want to say, there are people who can give $10,000. That's 40 people that are bought out of slavery by CSI. They are going into these danger zones. They are doing the hard work, the boots on the ground, to free people from slavery by radical Muslims who believe slavery is a fine thing to do to people who don't agree with you theologically. It's horrific. It's happening. We need to face it. And better yet, we need to do something about it. So we say all these things hoping to educate you. You have to go to CSI, which is the website, which is our website, metaxastalk.com. The banner says CSI.
Yes.
You can give any way you want. It's just, there's so many different ways to give. Everybody who gives $100 gets a free subscription to Metaxas Super, which is $100 tax deductible. So you get free, commercial-free podcasting and on and on and on. Anybody who gives $250 gets a signed copy of Donald Builds the Wall, plus two subscriptions to Metaxas Super, and on and on and on. We want to incentivize you, but you have to go to MetaxasTalk.com. And don't forget to sign up for our weekly newsletter, which is at ericmetaxas.com, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. And don't forget to follow me on Instagram. I keep forgetting. I'm on Instagram now. Please follow me. Goodbye. We'll be right back. Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad.
prospero año y felicidad.
Hey there, folks. Feliz Navidad. Merry Christmas. It's still early in December, but I'm getting into the spirit of things, like all those people that I've hated all over all the years who get into it too early. I've become one of those people. I think it's because the Christmas special is coming up. TBN, we filmed a Christmas variety special. It will blow your mind. I'm just warning you in advance. But we're not going to talk about that right now. We're going to talk right now. I have the joy of sitting here in the studio in New York with an old friend, Owen Strahan, who has written a number of books. The brand new book, which is in my hands, is called Reenchanting Humanity, A Theology of Mankind. Owen, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Eric. Great to be here.
You you have some very impressive blurbs on the book. Al Mohler, Wayne Grudem, Ligon Duncan III. I mean, these are big names in certain theological circles. And the title of your book is really impressive, Reenchanting Humanity, A Theology of Mankind. So the question, of course, is, what does that mean? But before you answer that, let me tell people that you are officially Associate Professor of Christian Theology and Director of the Center for Public Theology and Director of the Residency PhD Program at Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary in Kansas City, Missouri. Okay, so that's who you are. What do you mean by Reenchanting Humanity, A Theology of Mankind? Really big idea.
Yeah, we've been told that we're basically just a clump of cells as human beings.
Who told
today.
You that?
Oh, you hear it out there in the scientific community.
Yeah.
You know, you engage these kind of arguments as well.
Yeah.
And so there's no real meaning to our humanity. A lot of people think that they're just matter. They're just atoms colliding. And so in this book, I'm trying to make the case that we need to reenchant humanity. In other words, we need to see humanity in light of divine creation, recognizing that the Lord God Almighty made us, and according to Genesis 1, 26 to 28, made us in his image. And so when you start from that standpoint, you've got a very strong understanding of this race that stands above all else that is in creation and that bears God's glory in a unique, distinct way. So that's what I'm after.
Forgive me for coughing. Stop. Wow. I'm just going to keep going. Okay. You've just summed it up beautifully. Forgive me for coughing here. But this is the question of our time.
Mm-hmm.
Who are we? And you are making a theological case. Why a theological case?
I'm making a theological case. The other dimensions matter of humanity, but I'm making it because fundamentally we will not know who we are as human beings unless we go to God's definition of the human race. So we recognize that he makes humanity on the sixth day, the sixth day of creation, and he makes us in his image and likeness. If you don't start there, Eric, I don't know how you're going to rediscover who humanity is. You're going to end up defining humanity by our feelings, by our background, by our skin color, by all sorts of things. And those things matter in different ways, but they're not first and foremost what we want to say humanity is. We're the special creation of Almighty God. We want to start there.
Okay, now it's such a beautiful idea, but it's a beautiful idea that's fallen on hard times because for at least the last 100 years, people have said that the early chapters of Genesis, I mean, hey, come on, it's a folk tale, it's a talking snake. And so they throw out the baby with the bathwater because even if you have trouble explaining certain parts of it, the beautiful idea that we are created in the image of God, we don't really think about that much.
Mm-hmm.
What a beautiful poetic idea. Why would God create us in his image? Why? I mean, I wouldn't create anything in my image. I would just create other stuff. He creates us in his image.
Yes.
It's a glorious idea. Even if it weren't true, it would be an incredibly beautiful concept. But we don't really look to the early chapters of Genesis in the way that we did. That's kind of fallen out of the larger cultural narrative. And what you point out and what we can talk about is the idea that when you pull that idea out, everything bad follows. I mean, it really does reduce us dramatically to nothing, to meaninglessness, which is the worst thing, meaninglessness, because
yes,
we crave meaning. That's, by the way, because God created us in his image, we happen to crave meaning and so on and so forth. So when you talk about reenchanting humanity, I guess one of my questions that I want to ask you, and I'll ask you now, is why do you say re-enchanting humanity? Because it's, for me, it's a worldview issue. Mm-hmm. It touches on a lot. But why do you talk about enchantment? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I was reading the works of the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor in preparation for this book, and he used the term enchantment. And he was talking about it in reference to secularism and how secularism has really taken the light out of our eyes. And so I kind of lifted the concept, if you will, from Mr. Taylor, thanks to him, and brought it back into my understanding of the Christian worldview. And what I'm after here is I'm trying to say we're not just an evolved animal. Again, we're not just a clump of cells. We're not a blank slate in the 18th century philosophical understanding. You've got movements like the Enlightenment. You know, we could do a deep dive on these kind of things. But very quickly, a figure like John Locke is someone who says, famously defines humanity as a blank slate. Fast forward about 220 years to our time, Eric, and you've got lots of people basically believing that they're a blank slate. In other words, that they create their own identity. They frequently look to their feelings, their inmost desires, to define what that slate is going to look like. What I'm trying to say is God gave us feelings. He gave us affections. It's not bad to feel. He wants us to feel after him. But we're not going to understand who we are, and we're not going to grasp the full dignity and worth and beauty of the human race unless we know that God made us in his image and has given us a script to live out as men and women and Christians in this world as those who give him conscious glory as we make our way on the earth. That's what I'm after.
Well, that's beautifully said. It's interesting, the word re-enchant, obviously, if you break it down to enchant,
yes.
The word chant, I believe, is etymologically related to singing.
Mm.
And so in a funny way, it's like putting the song or putting the soul back into the machine, into the animal, right?
Mm-hmm.
And whether I'm making an etymological mistake or I'm not,
I like it.
You're talking about putting the soul back.
Mm-hmm.
We are not just, you know, to use the ugliest phrase ever, meat robots. We're not just machines. We're not just purposeless animals like weevils or amoeba. Mm-hmm. We are something else. I don't know who it was who called us walking poems. I always think it's Chesterton, but I can never find the quote. But the point is that throughout history, human beings, whether they subscribe to the biblical narrative or don't, have known that we are something beyond creatures that just live and die, that there is something special, that there is something that even if we don't know what it is and even if we can't put our finger on it, that it's there. You're saying, I'm gathering, that the Enlightenment and the last couple of centuries have sucked that out of us and that we have become people who define ourselves largely in the culture as soulless. We don't talk about the soul. We're just, you know, I need food, drink, vodka, and something over my head. It's like what the communists used to reduce people
yes.
to. You're just a creature,
right.
And you get bread, vodka, and an ugly building, and a crummy job, and you should be satisfied. And you
yes.
think, well, wait a minute, but the soul is not satisfied. I am crushed unless I have. And so when you say re-enchanting humanity, it seems to me that you're trying to help people capture that once more. That's kind of at the heart of what you're saying.
It is. Let's make the soul great again, if you will. I mean, really, we've got to understand that we are not just a body. Actually, God made the body.
Right.
So God loves the body. Christians are those who should love the body and should make a case for that in public and that
right.
sort of thing. And yet, we recognize that we have a soul in order that we would know God. The Enlightenment, Hume, Kant, and others several hundred years ago, basically, if we reduce their arguments, they claim that unless you can prove something empirically,
right.
unless you can, you know, put it in a test tube and verify it,
right.
then you can't really believe in it. I mean,
right.
you can have your precious moments, your special quiet times. That's great for you, but that's not provable. And
right.
that's really a scientistic worldview, which you've done so much to critique. Very thankful for that. We've got to make very clear as Christians today that we have a soul and that that soul is given us specially so that we would commune with the living God. It's not an accident. It's not this thing we're embarrassed about. Lots of people around us are living as robots and materialists, and it
yeah.
doesn't work.
No, it doesn't work, and it's actually horrifying because we have seen how it plays out. You can look in any direction. I mean, if somebody really believes that their life is meaningless, that there's no meaning to the universe, right, that we got here by accident, it follows, if my life is meaningless, that there's no such thing as good or evil. Now, it really takes some imagination to try to comprehend what the world would be like if good and evil did not exist. It's almost impossible. And the reason it's impossible is because it's a lie and our brains aren't wired to believe something that absurd. But it's so dark, and we do have to fight back against it. And your book, Reenchanting Humanity, A Theology of Mankind, is a great way to do that. We're going to be right back talking to Owen Strahan about his new book and all kinds of stuff. Stick around.
It's a marshmallow world in the winter, when the snow comes to cover the ground. It's time for play, it's a whipped cream day, I wait for it to hold you around.
Hey folks, that's Dean Martin singing Marshmallow World. You just wait till this TBN Christmas TV variety special comes out. Victoria Jackson and I sing that song. We do a peppier version of it, kind of like the one that Dean sang with Frank Sinatra in the 1967 Dean Martin Christmas variety special, in case you care. But we're talking about something a little different right now. We're talking about, but not unrelated, the book is called Reenchanting Humanity, A Theology of Mankind by Owen Strahan. And I want to say, Strahan is spelled S-T-R-A-C-H-A-N. So it looks like Strachan, but it's pronounced Strahan. What kind of a name is Strahan?
It's a Scottish last name with a Gaelic pronunciation. So you can say it different ways. In some contexts, it's Strachan, which sounds very manly. So,
Strachan.
Yeah, I like that one.
Yeah.
I say it Stran.
Yeah.
Most commonly.
Right.
But it's kind of like do what you see fit. With
Strachan. Owen Strachan. Okay, Owen Strahan, let me ask you a little bit more about this book. You've written a number of books, by the way. Was your first book the book that you wrote on Chuck Colson?
That was one of my first books, The Colson Way.
Okay, The Colson Way, because we're both fans of Chuck Colson.
That's right.
And I almost fainted because you dedicated that book to me, which was truly shocking, and I'm very grateful for that. You've also written a book called The Awakening, Awakening the Evangelical Mind, an Intellectual History of the Neo-Evangelical Movement, which I want to talk about in our second hour together. It's an important thing. But right now we're focusing on your brand new book, Reenchanting Humanity, A Theology of Mankind. For whom did you write this book? Is it overly theological, or is it something that a more mainstream reader could tackle?
So it is theological. I wrote it for the church primarily to instruct people in what it means to be the image, made in the image of God, what it means that we're sinners, that's chapter 2, why we do work on the earth, that's chapter 3, what it means to be a man or a woman. That's an area of tremendous confusion today, as you well know, Eric, with all sorts of people not being sure about what it means to be a boy or a girl. You've got boys entering girl track meets and these sorts of things. I mean, it's just happening like crazy. You've got boys entering the girls' restroom in public schools and public areas. So that's another major section of this book, gender and sexuality, because people, again, you stop somebody on the street out here in New York City, people do not necessarily know how to define manhood or womanhood.
Oh, that's an understatement. I mean, yeah. These concepts have fallen on hard times. It's why I wrote my book, Seven Men, because I thought to myself, young men in particular need models.
Yes.
And that led me to writing, you know, Seven Women and Seven More Men. But it's like this is a real crisis right now. And it's been the case roughly for the last 50 years. I mean, the intellectual roots go back far, but it's come into the popular culture really in the last 50 or so years.
Yes.
And it strikes me that, you know, the Bible is pretty clear on this kind of thing. So what does the culture say? What is their version of this? I mean, or let's start with what does the Bible say before we talk about how the culture gets it wrong?
Yeah, so you start with the scripture. You go to Genesis 2, and you recognize that the Lord creates Adam from the dust of the ground, Genesis 2, 7. And then he calls him in Genesis 2, 15 to work the ground of Eden and to watch over or keep the garden. And so right there off the bat, You've got protection. You've got provision there put on the man's shoulders. And then the woman is created from his rib, and he's called to hold fast to her. So he's called to lead his wife. This never means, of course, abusively lead her or something like this. It's going to be defined, this leadership, in Ephesians 5 in terms of Jesus Christ, who lays his life down for his bride, his wife, if you will. And so men are called in Scripture to be self-sacrificial, to put women and children before them, to be hard workers, to be those who protect, to be those who provide. But as you just referenced, our culture has lost sight of those kind of roles, those callings for a man.
Yeah.
So young men, really, if you polled them, yeah, I think your average young guy today would not know exactly what it means that he is a man.
Right. And it's such a basic idea. I mean, it doesn't get more basic that we need to know these things. We can hardly function in the world if we don't know these things. And I do think it's why we have such social breakdown, because, yes, if a man doesn't know what it is to be a man and a husband and a father and how to lead in a loving way, in a self-sacrificial way, the way Christ commands us to do,
yeah,
he will be lost, and he will attract to himself a woman who is similarly lost. It's almost ironic that she's complementarily lost, you know, that,
right,
you have this double confusion, and, you know, women are trying to lead. And everybody knows, like, when you're dancing, the man is supposed to lead. It doesn't mean he's a better dancer. He could be, right, a much worse dancer, but the rules, kind of like in baseball, the man leads. And so it's the woman's job, mm-hmm, to follow, even if he's leading not so well, not to, mm-hmm, lead. And we're living in a culture right now where that makes people's heads explode. They cannot,
yes,
get that.
Yes.
And it's offensive. And it needn't be, but we hardly have people making the case for why it's a good thing. And it takes guts in this day and age to talk about this kind of thing, because people are just instantly offended, and they're hearing all the wrong things.
They are. You know, and there's all sorts of messages given to women today. It's really a feminist age and a feminist culture. The Bible has an enchanted vision of womanhood, I would argue. When a woman trusts Christ and knows Christ as her Savior, she understands there's all sorts of things that God calls her to do in Christ. We understand that the roles of mother, the role of wife, the role of homemaker, the role of those who raise children in different ways, these are God-glorifying roles in the Bible. Our culture may sneer at them.
Oh, I mean, they're sacred, and yeah, you're quite right that the culture sneers at them. We're going to be right back talking to Owen Strawn. The book is Reenchanting Humanity. Don't go away.
It's not the way I had him pictured. Santa was a much too thin. He didn't come down the chimney, so Mama must have let him in. Santa looked a lot like Daddy. Our Daddy looked a
hey there,
lot
folks.
Like
I hate to keep bringing up the TBN Christmas TV special, but I got to tell you, that song right there by Buck Owens, in the TBN Christmas special, we get on to Louisiana, to Duck Dynasty country, and there's a character called Gully, and he performs this song under the name Duck Owens. It's really freaky, and I recommend that you watch it. We're talking to a theologian, my friend Owen Strawn. The book is Reenchanting Humanity, A Theology of Mankind. Why did you feel the need, Owen, to write this now? In other words, it strikes me that most people in the church would know or would agree with what you're saying here. Is the main point of this to articulate it?
I think people today feel tremendous pressure from a secularizing and neo-pagan culture, really. In other words, people today do not know what it means to be human. Christians, of course, have a basic idea, but we're in such an oppositional moment. We understand that many people around us draft off of secularism to understand human origins. So there was a cosmic big bang, right? And we're just evolved matter, basically.
Yeah.
And then they go to neo-paganism, I argue in this book, by which I mean an understanding that we're kind of little gods and there's no real order to humanity and there's no script for our sexuality. Our body is kind of just the vessel of our desires, so we can do with it what we want. Eric, what I see is that a lot of Christians are falling prey to these kind of views. You have gay gay Christianity now cropping up in evangelical circles, transgender Christianity cropping up. So what I'm trying to do is just call Christians back to the richness of biblical doctrine on these matters and say, we don't need to fear the culture on these counts. We have a beautiful vision of humanity that I actually think is going to be evangelistic if we will just share it with people and call them back to who God made us to be.
I agree with that. It's interesting, you know, when you talk about the Big Bang and stuff, it's funny because one of the people, one of the principal proponents in the last decades of this scientistic, materialistic worldview was Carl Sagan, who's no longer with us. But I remember him saying in these kind of dramatic tones that, you know, I don't remember the exact phrase, but he would basically say that, you know, the universe is all there is and all that's ever been. Mm-hmm. And we are made of the same stuff that the stars are made of, right? And I thought to myself, he's basically lying, not just because he's getting it factually correct, but there's hypocrisy because he's trying to put English on the ball and make it sound romantic and beautiful. Yes. And he says, we are made of the same stuff that the stars are made of. And I thought to myself, wait a second. When you say star, you mean flaming ball of gas. You don't mean something beautiful.
Yeah.
You mean flaming ball of gas. And so he kind of spins it to make it sound kind of beautiful and romantic and whatever. But what he's actually saying is no. There's nothing. But he's almost trying to celebrate the nothing in a way that contradicts precisely what he is saying about who we are and what the stars are. And I feel like there's this religious impulse in people that you can never escape it. They're always going to try to, square the circle. They cannot bear the bleakness of what they're saying.
Right.
So they somehow have to turn it into a religion that calls itself atheism or something. But meaning and purpose are so baked into who we are that even when you are anti-meaning and anti-purpose, you find yourself falling nonetheless into that kind of language.
You do. Back in Kansas City, I drove past a billboard driving my wife and three kids back from Thanksgiving.
Wait a minute. When did you get three kids? I feel like just a minute ago, you were getting married. Holy cow.
I just signed up online and they shipped them right
to my
door.
That's pretty nice. Right? That's swell.
So we're driving on the highway in Kansas City and there's a billboard that says, Happy Holidays from the Kansas City Atheists. And I thought, why is it a happy holidays, Kansas City atheists?
Right.
If there is no meaning and purpose and order in the cosmos, shouldn't I actually be probably most likely having a very bleak holiday season? Why would you foist this happiness upon me? Because it's not supported by your worldview.
Why not say, kill yourself, the Kansas City atheists? Why not?
Yeah.
Why? Meaning, life has no meaning. Like, what would be wrong with that?
Right.
Why? It's like crushing a bug.
Yeah.
Well, that's a little too logical for the Kansas City atheists.
Yeah.
Happy holidays.
Yeah. Have yourselves a very bleak Merry Christmas.
It's just, but I mean, again, it is funny. We have to be able to make fun of this stuff because, and we don't have to be mean about it. But I mean, ladies and gentlemen, let's at least dignify each other with honesty. When somebody says that we evolved out of the primordial soup through random mutations and accident, it follows logically. There's no escape that life is meaningless. So when you start talking about, well, we create our own meaning or whatever, why? Like,
right.
what are you even talking about? Why are you talking about meaning?
Right.
Tell me why you're even talking about meaning.
Yeah, and what flows out of that, I talk about this a little bit in the book, is a concept of extrinsic worth or extrinsic value. In other words, you need to earn your value. You need to show that you contribute to this society. You think of how in the UK, for example, there was a TV program a year ago where the host took a person with Down syndrome around and tabulated as the show went on just how costly this disabled person's life was. And it added up to something like $12 million for a single person with Down syndrome, something astronomical. And the clear implication of the show was, you're costing us more than you're contributing. Well, guess what? That's a theory of extrinsic worth. That's what our culture believes.
Excuse me, but before we go into that, that is word for word almost what the Nazis were preaching.
Yes.
Lives unworthy of life.
Yes.
And it is exactly what you say. It's extrinsic worth, that you have no inherent value, no intrinsic value. Mm-hmm. And so now we're going to judge you on what you do, what you contribute. If you're lying in bed and, you know, taking up the time and energy and the food order that could be used to ship to the soldiers at the front,
right,
we're going to euthanize you and we're going to ship the ashes home to your parents.
Yes.
That's literally what was happening. And you're telling me that now in the UK,
yes,
they are explicitly talking this way.
Right. And you think about 60 million babies aborted in America, the supposedly first world civilization. You recognize we need to recover the Christian doctrine of the image of God because it teaches us intrinsic value. It teaches us that the child with Down syndrome has infinite worth and infinite dignity and doesn't have to prove anything about that to be valued and treasured. We need to recover that kind of conception of the human person.
That's beautiful. We're going to be right back, folks. I'm talking to Owen Strawn. The book is Reenchanting Humanity.
By starlight, singing a Yuletide hymn. Oh, by gosh, by golly, it's time for mistletoe and holly.
Folks, that's Michael Jackson singing a song that is oddly reminiscent of Buck Owens' song from our last segment. I would sue if I were Buck Owens, but Buck Owens has gone on to the great beyond, as has Michael Jackson, so it's all good. I'm talking to Owen Strawn. The book is Reenchanting Humanity, A Theology of Mankind. It seems to me, Owen, that this would be a great book for pastors or spiritual leaders, because as you were saying, there are a lot of pastors, a lot of people in ministry themselves who don't get this stuff. They've kind of gotten pushed sideways by the culture.
Yeah, I don't think necessarily most pastors would deny the kind of things we're talking about, but we all feel such heat for holding these kind of views, these kind of principles, that I'm trying to do my small part with Reenchanting Humanity to strengthen pastors, to strengthen leaders, to strengthen lay Christians who love the Lord and want to stand for the truth in a fallen world. And so this book is aimed at shoring up your understanding of what God made humanity to be, a thing we really need to give attention to today.
Sexuality is, of course, like the hot button issue of our time. And what do you make of people who give what they consider biblical defenses of homosexual behavior? I'm fascinated, really, that there are people doing that.
Yeah, we recognize that all of us can understand where different desires and impulses come from. We recognize that because of the fall, the real historical fall of Adam, a real historical man in Genesis 3, we all have corrupt, sinful desires in us. So we're all in the same boat, in other words. But we can't take those sinful desires and mash them up with Christianity. So in this book, I'm speaking against the marriage, the uneasy marriage of homosexuality and Christianity or transgender and Christianity. I see in 1 Corinthians 6, 9 through 11, a call from the Apostle Paul to recognize that if you have those desires and you're a Christian, you need to recognize that that identity and that sinful desire has been crucified with Christ. So it used to be a part of how you defined yourself. It used to be your behavior. It used to be what you wanted most. Now it's crucified with Christ and you're a new creation in Him.
That's a dramatic thing. And, you know, my heart goes out to people who struggle in these areas. And I think sometimes we forget the struggle.
Yeah.
What a horrible, painful struggle it is. I mean, we all struggle in different ways. But to be born and to come into the world somehow desiring something that maybe isn't culturally acceptable or whatever, you think, what do you do that? And so, of course, you're longing for voices of approval. And I think we do have to understand that that is a real struggle, and we have to come around these people and love them.
Sure.
Because I know that the church has failed in that. But now, of course, we're failing in the opposite direction by saying, like, well, we forgot to affirm and love them and help them. So now we're just going to agree with the idea that
right,
this is a good thing, and that's not helpful either. We're out of time in this hour, Owen, but we're going to keep you here because I want to keep
Thank
talking
you.
To you about this and other issues. Folks, the book is Reenchanting Humanity, A Theology of Mankind. Owen, do you have a website that people can go to?
Yeah, the website I would push them to is mbts.cpt.edu.
Gesundheit. MB, say it again.
Actually, let me reverse that. cpt.mbts.edu.
cpt.mbts.edu,
just to make it really complicated.
.edu. cpt.mbts.edu. cpt.mbts.edu.
Yes, sir.
I just want to make sure people can find you.
Thank
Owen
you.
Strand. Strand is S-T-R-A-C-H-A-N. We'll be right back. Well, we won't be right back. We're going to go to hour two with Owen Strand. Thanks for listening.